They're in here.
The Environment, Economic Development, and Agricultural Division for Monday, February 4th, 2013, will come to order. A quorum is present. We're going to do some more budget overviews today, and we're just going to start out with Mr. Mueller. Do we have that in the, yeah, everybody's got this in their packet. And it's, I'll have Mr. Mueller explain what it actually is, and if you all want to study it closely, please do. Senator Rood.
Mr. Chair and members, I have a handout for you here today at the table, and it's just something that was in my local Brainerd paper, and I just wanted to bring it to your attention simply because Brainerd's jobless rate rose to 12.7%. And so as we're talking about jobs, and it has some of the other areas, and I know Senator Saxhog's communities are in here also, and so I just wanted to let you know that we're a little higher in greater Minnesota, so when we concentrate on jobs, that's our reality, 12.7% unemployment.
Thank you, Senator Rood. I appreciate that. I'm not sure we're going to do a newspaper article a year from now on, but I guess it's okay to point out the facts once in a while and have these as backups. So anyway, and incidentally, part of what we want to do here is create jobs, so be on board with some of this stuff, okay?
That's why I brought it to your attention, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Because we actually had a similar problem where we had some increases in unemployment as opposed to after employment went down, it's gone back up in a couple of cities. Senator Saxhog, was Grand Rapids going up? I think Virginia went up. I don't remember Grand Rapids.
Mr. Chair, Grand Rapids is in this article. It's 9.7, so it's just about in double digits. And it's consistently the highest on the range.
And that's Senator Scalzi.
And I'm wondering if we could define that. Is it like a December unemployment or what happens in July or August? I'm just kind of wondering if there's a difference.
Well, it's been going all over the board with the, you know, with the recession and recovering from the recession and trying to figure out what's going on exactly. But, you know, there was a point in 2009 where we weren't making one pellet on the iron range, so the unemployment was very high. So and that's all come back. So that's a good part of what's going on up there. And but the logging industry, I think, has still got problems, and those are some of our main employers. So Mr. Mueller, go ahead and describe this spreadsheet that we have.
excuse me, Mr. Chairman, members, what this spreadsheet is, I'll just spend a couple minutes going over it. It's just a general fund overview of the governor's budget for the agencies in this budget division. And again, this is just general fund and shows the new general fund spending and revenues created here. The first page are the environment area agencies. Pollution Control Agency has new general fund spending. The column you want to look at is Gov minus forecast. It's the first green column over towards the right. So this is the governor's budget versus the forecast.
So on line 13, that means the governor's recommendation is $926,000 above the forecast?
Mr. Chairman, yes, for the Pollution Control Agency. Okay. So we'll quickly go through each of the agencies, and then we can... And this is something you can probably keep in your folders here and refer back to as we go through all the budget overviews. The DNR has $11.58 million in new spending recommended by the governor, general fund. Met Council Parks has no new general fund spending recommended by the governor. The Conservation Corps on line 32 has $910,000 of new general fund money. Board of Water and Soil Resources on line 39 has $1.15 million. No new spending for the zoo. The Science Museum, the governor's recommended a very small increase of $22,000. And then that transfer on line 45, that's something that's already in an existing law. That's a payback we owe to the closed landfill fund. The next page, we have Department of Ag has $670,000 in new general fund money, and that's it for the ag area. Commerce, who we'll be hearing from today, they'll go through more detail, but they're proposing about just over $3 million in new general fund expenditures in the governor's budget, and they'll go through that today. That's offset by some revenue that we'll show on the last page. Page 3 are the agencies in the economic development area. You'll see the this is where the majority of the new spending is occurring in this budget division is indeed the $55 million jobs program for jobs initiative. Housing Finance Agency on line 101 has a $13 million. That's a one-time increase in funding. Labor and Industry, $300,000 increase. Mediation Services, $482,000. You see, no governor's recommending no general fund money for the Science Technology Authority. That's a little bit of savings of $214,000. And Explore Minnesota Tourism is a $15 million increase. So you see the net, all areas, all general fund, on line 122 for the whole division is a $103 million general fund increase over the base in the governor's budget. And lastly, I'll point to general fund revenues created by the governor's budget in this area. These are all within the Department of Commerce. They're proposing about a $10 million increase in general fund revenues coming in. So that offsets that 103 expenditures by about $10 million. So you get a net general fund number on the last line there of $93.3 million. Later on when we get a target, we usually get targets based on expenditures, revenues, and then net. So I just want to point that out as we go through all the agencies' budgets. Maybe keep this in your folders and refer back to, but we'll have other spreadsheets later that detail all the other funds that are going on in the agencies, but this is just a general fund summary right now.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, again, to follow this, if I'm following it right, the percentage increases are on the line or that starts out in each particular area, or is it at the bottom of each area here? Looking at 47.9% increase total economic development, is that for that budget, or is it the – it would be, wouldn't it? Page –
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, just for that budget area, it is a 47.9.
Okay, so the one, the lower number. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And we would, Mr. Chairman, and as a total of general fund, you'll see on line 123 and 124, we've talked before about how big this budget area is compared to the rest of the general fund. In the forecast, we're about 1.4% of the general fund, and after the Gov's budget, we'd move up to about 1.7% of the general fund.
I like that. We got them down to the Gov now.
Right.
Any other questions of Mr. Mueller before we get going with the agenda? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mueller. Metropolitan Parks.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask one question real quick.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry. On page one, Mr. Mueller, the lands and minerals operation, that's a minus 4,022. Can you tell me why that is a minus? How that come about?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, and that's actually a minus $4 million in that division of DNR. When we start going through their budget, they have a pretty big proposals in the governor's budget to reduce the general fund expenditures in that division of DNR and replace it with fees that would go through the Natural Resources Fund. So when we start going through the governor's budget in DNR, you'll see how they what they're proposing to do in that part of the agency.
So follow up. So it's fair to say the fees obviously are going to go up then to offset these. Okay. Thanks.
If we decide that's the way to go.
Yeah.
Okay. Say your name for the record so we make sure we get it right, and tell us who you are, and then you may proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Arnie Steffrud. I'm the manager of the Regional Parks and Natural Resources at the Metropolitan Council, and in your packet is my PowerPoint presentation since this screen is not visible to all of you. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present the governor's budget for Metropolitan Regional Parks. I will cover three topics today. First of all, I'll give you an overview of what the Metropolitan Regional Park System is. Second, I'll present the governor's budget regarding general fund and natural resources fund appropriations for Metro Parks operations and maintenance. And third, I'll give the governor's budget regarding Metro Regional Park System funding out of the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund and link that to the 25-year Parks and Trails Legacy Plan strategic directions. In regards to what the Metro Regional Park System is, in 1974, the Metropolitan Parks Act established the Metropolitan Regional Park System. The Parks Act directed the Metropolitan Council to prepare a regional parks policy plan. That plan generally identifies land which should be acquired for regional parks and trails by cities, counties, and special park districts. These regional parks and trails, together with state parks and trails, are supposed to meet the outdoor recreational needs of metropolitan area residents and visitors. The Metro Parks Act also directs the Metro Council to grant state and regional capital dollars to the regional park agencies so that they can acquire land and develop park and trail units that are called for in the regional parks policy plan. Finally, in 1985, a law was enacted that directs the Metro Council to distribute state appropriations that supplement local funding and park user fees to operate and maintain the regional park system. What is the regional park system? It is owned and operated by 10 regional park implementing agencies, which include the counties of Anoka, Ramsey, Washington, Dakota, Scott, and Carver County, plus the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, the City of St. Paul, and the City of Bloomington. Also, Three Rivers Park District oversees regional parks in suburban Hennepin County. Some of these agencies also own and manage local parks, which are not part of the regional park system. The system currently open to the public encompasses 54,842 acres. It hosted 44 million visits in 2011. There are currently 39 regional parks, including Lake Waconia Park, which is managed by Carver County. Regional parks range in size from 100 to 500 acres. There are also 12 park reserves. Park reserves range in size from 1,000 to 5,000 acres. An example of a park reserve is Rice Creek Chain of Lakes, which is managed by Anoka County. Regional parks and park reserves offer facilities for picnicking, camping, swimming, boating, fishing, environmental education, and trail opportunities. There are 7 special recreation features in the regional park system. These special recreation features provide one-of-a-kind outdoor recreation and environmental education facilities and programs. Examples include the Como Zoo and Conservatory in St. Paul, plus the Nuremberg Floral Gardens, managed by Three Rivers Park District. Finally, there are 38 regional trails that total 308 miles. These regional trails provide a network that connect the regional parks and park reserves together. One example is the Big Rivers Regional Trail, which is managed by Dakota County Parks. The long-range plan for the park system is 1,000 acres of parkland, 70,000 acres of parkland, and 1,000 miles of regional trails. The annual visits to the regional park system are estimated based on sample counts collected each summer, plus campground registration data and special event data. This chart illustrates the estimated visits from 1974 to 2011. Growth has gone from 5 million visits a year to 44 million visits. Growth is due to 3 factors. 1, expansion of the regional park system with the acquisition of land and development of that land into regional park and trail units. 2, the population growth of the region. And 3, marketing of these parks and trail units by the regional park implementing agencies and the Metropolitan Council. These parks are regionally significant because they serve persons who live throughout the 7-county metropolitan region, as well as visitors to the region from greater Minnesota and elsewhere. Based on research conducted in 2008, 45% of the visits to the regional park system are non-local visitors. A non-local visitor is a person who lives outside the jurisdiction of the park agency that manages that park. For example, a resident of Ramsey County who visits a regional park managed in Washington County is a non-local visitor. Conversely, 55% of the visits to regional parks and trails are local visits. Those are visits by people who live in the jurisdiction that manages that regional park. For example, a resident of St. Paul that visits Como Regional Park is a local visitor. Now that I provided you with a background on what the Metropolitan Regional Park system is, I'll present the governor's budget regarding General Fund and Natural Resources Fund appropriations for Metro Regional Park's operations and maintenance. In 1985, law was enacted that authorized the Metro Council to disperse state appropriations to regional park implementing agencies to supplement local property taxes and user fee revenues used to finance operations and maintenance of the Metropolitan Regional Park system. The state appropriations are financed from the General Fund and the Natural Resources Fund. A total of $145 million of state appropriations have been made for this purpose from fiscal year 1986 to fiscal year 2013. State funds have financed 9.6% of total operations and maintenance costs during this time period. The governor recommends for fiscal year 2014 and 15 that $2.87 million from the general fund be appropriated per year and $5.67 million from the natural resources fund be appropriated per year. That maintains the state support at the same level as the fiscal year 2012-2013 biennium. To put this recommendation into context, this pie chart shows the share of calendar year 2011 Metro Regional Parks operations and maintenance expenses financed with state and local sources. The state general fund financed 3% of those costs. Natural Resources Fund financed 5.8% for a combined state contribution of 8.8%. Property taxes collected by the regional park agencies financed 73.4%, and park user fees financed 17.8% of the cost to operate and maintain the system in 2011, and that total cost was $95 million. I will conclude my presentation with an overview of the governor's fiscal year 2014-15 Parks and Trails Legacy Fund budget for Metro Regional Parks. The Parks and Trails Legacy Plan has strategic directions which provide guidance on how to spend Parks and Trails Legacy Fund appropriations. Those strategic directions are, first, to connect people to the outdoors. There are many ways to do that, including improved marketing to attract folks who are currently not visiting parks and trails, as well as developing programs and activities that attract new visitors. Second, acquire land, especially acquire parcels within existing park and trail boundaries, and also acquire new parks to serve underserved areas. Three, create opportunities for developing new facilities in existing parks, as well as facilities in new parks and trails to attract new visitors. Four, take care of what we have through the renovation of existing regional park and trail infrastructure, as well as restoration of natural resource areas in those parks and trails. Finally, park agencies should work better together to create a seamless network of parks and trails of regional significance. That is done through interagency planning and cooperation. To summarize the governor's fiscal year 2014-15 budget, he proposes $32,394,000 of legacy funds for the Metro Regional Park system. This pie chart shows how much would be spent to further the strategic directions of the Parks and Trails Legacy Plan. 2.74% or $886,000 would be spent on programs to connect people to the outdoors. $18.6 million or 57.5% would be spent to create new opportunities by building new park and trail facilities. $6.24 million or 19.3% would be spent to take care of what we have by replacing worn out park and trail facilities. And $105,000 or 0.3% would be spent on programs for interagency cooperation working better together. And finally, $6.53 million or 20% would be spent to acquire land. 90% of the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund appropriations for the Metro Regional Park System is distributed to the 10 regional park implementing agencies under a formula in state law. The weighting of each factor in that formula is as follows. 35% of that money is split amongst the agencies based upon their share of the population of the seven-county metropolitan area. 20% is based upon the number of annual visits that park agency hosts relative to the total number of annual visits to the regional park system. 20% is based upon the amount that park agency spent annually to operate and maintain its portion of the regional park system. 15% is based on the number of non-local visits that agency hosted compared to all non-local visits to the system. And finally, 10% is based on the amount of regional park and trail land that park agency manages. The remaining 10% of the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund appropriation must be spent to acquire land. That money is matched where every $1 of legacy funds is matched with $1.20 of Metro Council bonds and non-state funds provided by the regional park agency that is acquiring land. Park acquisition grants are awarded when land is available to purchase from willing sellers based on negotiations from certified appraisals. The amount each park agency would receive from that 90% of the appropriation is shown here. Anoka County would receive $2.78 million, the City of Bloomington $556,000, Carver County $567,000, Dakota County $2.26 million, Three Rivers Park District $7.06 million, the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board $6.2 million, Ramsey County $2.5 million, the City of St. Paul $4.58 million, Scott County $1.06 million, and Washington County, $1.58 million. Here are examples of past projects funded with Parks and Trails legacy dollars. A photo on the upper left corner is the construction of the replacement for the Eastman Nature Center at Elm Creek Park Reserve in Three Rivers Park District. This was financed with a number of Parks and Trails legacy fund grants beginning in fiscal year 2010. Construction of a trail in Spring Lake Regional Park in Scott County in the upper right-hand corner. This, along with other facilities, are being developed in that new park in Scott County. And then in the lower right corner, Conservation Corps of Minnesota crews are working in many of the park agencies. And here's an example, doing tree planting at Bunker Hills Regional Park in Anoka County. At the end of your packet is a detailed list of all of the projects proposed to be funded with that 90% of the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund appropriation that is split among the 10 park agencies. You have the details by park agency, where it would be spent by the park unit name, and the amount for that particular project by fiscal year. That concludes my presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Stefford, that trail in Spring Lake Park, what's it for? Is it for bikes or walking?
Mr. Chair and members, that trail is for bikes and walking, also inline skating.
So you don't have snowmobiles on there? Because I see it's a winter picture. So
Mr. Chair, yes, this is a winter photograph, but there are snowmobile trails elsewhere in the regional park system, but not on these paved trails typically. Okay.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stefrud, thank you for the report. You have an acquisition plan for the Metro Parks when it comes to acquisition?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, we do. It is part of the Parks Policy Plan, and as I mentioned in my presentation, 10% of this appropriation, or about $3.3 million, would be used to acquire property, along with the Minneapolis Park Board is using a portion of its share of that 90% to acquire land for above the Falls Regional Park.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe a better question would be, is that kind of the average of what you've been looking at as far as acquisition over the years?
Mr. Chair, in addition to these dollars, we also get funding from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund to buy property of high-quality natural resource features. And in the past several bienniums, we've been averaging about $2 million per year for land acquisition. Those dollars, along with legacy dollars, are matched. For every dollar of state money, there's $1.20 of Metro Council bonds and park agency funds used to acquire those properties.
Thank you.
Mr. Stiffer, what do you get any kind of bonding money from the state for?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, we get state bond funds as well.
Can you give me a little explanation, just a brief explanation of what you get and what you use it for?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, in the last several bienniums, 2008, 2010, and 11 bonding bills, in both of those years, we received approximately $10.5 million of state bonds per biennium, and we matched that with $7 million of Metro Council bonds per biennium.
And it was used for?
That was used primarily for park facility development and renovation of existing parks.
Senator Westrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Related to your question, just you indicated that some trails you don't allow snowmobiles on, and they were the tar trails. Is that generally the gist? And if I heard you right, what's the reason for that?
Mr. Chair and members, each park implementing agency determines where the snowmobiling is allowed. And typically, there are turf trails available for snowmobiles, since many of them have spike treads, and they would be would damage a paved trail surface.
Okay. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Steffrud. Can you help me understand a little bit more of the Work Better Together program and what that would entail?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair and members, that's essentially for joint programming and marketing between agencies, so that you expand and utilize those dollars more effectively by joint efforts between several of these park agencies working on a particular project.
Is the $105,000 an employee, or is it marketing, or is it a combination, or is it you already got somebody working in it?
Mr. Chair and members.
And which agencies are you trying to work with?
Yes, and I can provide you with more details on that. It's not in your handout. But I will respond to that question and get back to you specifically on what those projects are.
Well, it's not a big amount. I just just wondering. I think Senator Sparks might have brought it up because we would hope agencies cooperate without having to put money into something to make them cooperate. But I know oftentimes we don't communicate with each other, and so maybe it's a good idea that we force you to do it by giving you some money to do it. I don't know, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is one of the programs that gets this money, Peace in the Valley money, but they have, the DNR has a Let's Go Fishing program that they do statewide. I know they're having ice fishing, I believe, February 16th, and then in June they do Take Your Kids Fishing, and they do coordinate and work quite well with the Minneapolis park system, so I don't know if they get any of this money, but they do a lot of promotion for that event in Minneapolis, and so there might be, that's just an idea where the two agencies work together to promote it in Minneapolis, so I don't know if that is part of the money or not.
So working better together might have a different meaning is what you're saying.
Well, I mean, that is a program where there's joint agencies working together to promote throughout the state, and so that might, I don't know. It's just an idea where I know they do work together.
Senator Dibble, did you have your hand up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a point. It's a point I often make, which is I think I walked in partway through the presentation. My apologies. So Mr. Steffrud may have made this point, but these sometimes, you know, because in the metro area, these are parks that are often owned and operated by local units of government. People wonder why so much state money in these. These are, you know, the metro equivalent, of course, of state parks, and I can attest, I live steps away from Lake Calhoun and Lake of the Isles. The amount of use that these regional parks in the metro area receive you can't even park in my neighborhood any day the summer, weekday, you know, around the clock. The amount of pressure that there is on these parks is tremendous.
I don't
tremendous.
Like being down here either. I don't blame. I don't like being down here either. I don't blame you for not.
Well, I love it. I love living there because I can just literally walk out my front door and, you know, half a block away, and I'm on the chain of lakes. It's fantastic. I actually really enjoyed the fact that one of my opponents one time decided to go down and campaign on the walking trails, because if one in 20 people was from the district, I'd be surprised. So that's great. Go keep campaigning down at Lake Calhoun. That's awesome. Just a quick question for Mr. Steffrud. Is there any federal money, any federal dollars that come in to the metro area as a result? I didn't see. I don't know if I caught any federal. I understand there are federal matching dollars.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stafford. Dibble, yes. In this particular project list, $17 million of federal transportation enhancement grants would be leveraged, if you will, with legacy dollars for trail projects, and the individual projects are listed here. But I don't have a column for the federal money. It's stated in the project description for that particular trail.
Senator Saxhawk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Stefrud, are parks and trails, or any of them in the seven county area? Was it seven? Are any of them wildlife areas?
Mr. Chair and members, the park reserves, 80% of those park reserve lands are basically wildlife habitat. Plus, there are areas within the regional parks that are also wildlife habitat. We also have state wildlife management areas in the seven-county metropolitan area as well.
And Mr. Chair, the reason I was asking that is it would seem to me that there's obviously a portion of Lasard Sams that is interested in outdoor heritage and wildlife management areas. Have you ever considered any particular grants or acquiring areas through Lasard Sams?
Mr. Chair and members, the Metro Regional Park Agency submitted through the council a request to Lasard Sams heritage funding this past June for $6.3 million, and that would have financed 15 or 16 projects, wildlife habitat restoration and enhancement that would essentially enhanced or restored about 2,400 acres of parklands for wildlife.
Mr. Chair, how'd it go?
Mr. Chair and members, the review of that proposal, the scoring by the council members, we missed it being considered for hearing by 2 points.
Mr. Chair, I'm assuming you're going to come back this year.
Mr. Chair and members, we intend to request dollars again in the future.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Scordy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to Senator Dibble's point about the Metro Parks being comparable to the state park system, I think a more accurate analogy would be if you look at Bemidji, they have Diamond Point Park, which is a local government-owned park that is more day use from a variety of people, and there's Library Park where they would hold music events that people from the region would come and attend, as opposed to the state park system, which would be like Lake Bemidji State Park, where I think the vast majority of the people who would be attending the state park would be from all over the, you know, the state or the country for that matter. So I think the metro parks are more comparable to some of those regionally, locally government-owned facilities and not the state park system. I think the state parks are truly our state responsibility. These other parks are more of a local government responsibility.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, we'll have to have this conversation. maybe not here today, but I disagree with that analysis and perspective. If we had state park, I mean, we have, you know, the Mississippi River Valley, but otherwise we just don't have anything comparable in the metropolitan area. And the actual numbers of folks who use these metropolitan regional parks, you know, runs past the use of the state parks fairly significantly. And, you know, and that's been an understanding for quite some time, kind of the moral equivalent, as Phyllis Kahn likes to use that expression, the moral equivalent of the state parks that are funded with state resources in greater Minnesota are these metropolitan regional parks. And they do have, you know, the kinds of certainly daytime active and passive recreational opportunities, but they also have all kinds of activities, including camping and other kinds of things as well. And I'm aware, and this, you know, this is a point that we're raising, of course, because the subject of the rural-urban split in the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund has become an issue. It was kind of 50-50 for a while, but now it's becoming skewed. And these these regional parks, which are local units of government that serve a smaller catchment area, a smaller population, are starting to claim a take on these legacy dollars that I don't think was originally envisioned or intended, because they don't serve the broader population from all kinds of different areas the way the metropolitan regional parks really do. I mean, I wasn't exaggerating. If it's 1 in 20, you know, that walking around or doing whatever they're doing around, you know, the lakes near me, I mean, that's probably, that come from my district, that's probably an exaggeration. I mean, these are folks coming from all over the place. Same is true of Elm Creek and, you know, all these regional parks. They really do serve a broad population that come from all over. In some cases, much broader, with much higher use than even the state parks. These greater Minnesota regional parks really are city or local parks.
Senator Scoid, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I disagree with your characterization of what the library park in Bemidji is. I'm sure if you go there on any day in the summertime, the vast majority of the people utilizing that park do not live in Bemidji. It's the tourists that are coming, and of course it's an economic benefit to have those folks coming, but they're utilizing that park. The state park, as opposed to that, is more of an overnight stay facility where people go and camp for a weekend. And I would, and I'm sure somebody from DNR can get us that information, but I would speculate that certainly the majority and probably the vast majority of the people there at Bemidji's, you know, Lake Bemidji State Park aren't from Bemidji area. They're from all over the state. They're very likely the majority of them from the metropolitan area in my mind, but I don't know that. I would guess they could analyze that data by zip code also. So I think you got to kind of separate the state parks out. That's a state responsibility. Then look at the local unit government parks and understand that they're regional in nature, and there's more people in the metropolitan area, so you know, they're getting pretty good usage down here, but those local regional parks are utilized by people from across the state also.
Well, this where the one Minnesota argument comes in, or this where, I mean, Senator Dibble, go ahead, and then Senator Scalzi.
Well, Ms. Chair, the simple fact of the matter is that there are 71 state parks in greater Minnesota. There are three in the metropolitan area. And, you know, and a lot of these state parks are used by, used for daytime activity. I mean, they're used much like the regional parks are in the metropolitan area. You know, the metropolitan area is underserved by the state park system.
That's not true.
It is true.
Okay, we're not,
you know,
gonna,
they're not all used
we're
for
not
overnight
we're not gonna
stays.
Agree. You know, I got you guys set up so you're kind of mingled. So you're supposed to get along with each other, you know. Here now. So it's obvious we're not going to agree on this one. But Senator Scalzi, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in my district, we have two metro regional parks. But actually, out of the 30 to 40 square miles that we've got, I only have two. Now, I might have 30 local parks that are funded totally by local governments. And so there's a real split between the metro regional parks, which are considered state parks, and the local parks. There's a big split. I've got 25 lakes, probably 30 to 40 square miles. So we pay through the property taxes as for all of our local parks. Not so much, you know, only two metro regional parks in my district, which are really wildlife habitat parks. Not a lot there that I could use, but there's a lot of deer and wildlife. So there is a difference.
Senator Osborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd love to keep throwing gasoline on Democrat on Democrat, but question regarding Connect to the People and Outdoors. Can you give me an explanation on some of the programs that $886,000 would be going to? What types of outreach programs, marketing programs you're talking about with that item?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, what we're talking about is environmental education programs in Ramsey County and Senator Scalzi's district, Tamarack Nature Center. There's a staff person that's funded out of legacy dollars to do environmental education in that park as well as throughout Ramsey County. The City of St. Paul has a similar position for environmental education, and there's also volunteer coordinators to increase the number of people providing environmental ed programming for visitors to these parks and trails. Anoka County has something similar to that as well. So those are examples of connecting people to the outdoors.
Mr. Chair, so it's really not so much marketing in a classical sense of you're going out to newspaper, multimedia, that kind of stuff. It's much more in-house educational, reaching out perhaps to school districts and to other venues as opposed to the general, what I would consider is mass marketing.
Mr. Chair and Senator Osmick, that's correct. There's also some enhancements of displays, for instance, in Anoka County regarding environmental education. There's a Wargo Nature Center, and they've made improvements there of physical environmental education materials, if you will. But it is directly consumer linked. It isn't taking out ads in newspapers or television time.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Steffrud, just recently, I think, and maybe you did report on this, and I apologize if I didn't get it, but there was a meeting going on, I think, broader meeting to talk about that, more of a One Minnesota thing, where regional parks as well as the DNR and rural parks got together, and they came up with a figure. Now, that figure, to me, doesn't sound anywhere close to 50-50, but was there not some numbers that came up? Knowing very well, I think maybe just for education of those members that weren't here, the first biennium, 14% went to rural Minnesota. Now, after this last biennium, 20% exclusively is going to the rural Minnesota. Where is that in the process? I know there's been talk about going 40-40-20, respectively, DNR, Metro, and 20 for rural. Where is that in the process? Can you tell us that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes. The 2011 legislators session directed the DNR to convene a 9-person working group comprised of 3 people representing Greater Minnesota Parks, 3 people representing DNR Parks, and 3 people representing Metro Regional Parks to develop a consensus recommendation on the allocation of Parks and Trails legacy dollars amongst those 3 park systems for the fiscal year 14-15 budget. That work group completed its task and recommended that 40% be allocated for DNR parks, 40% for Metro Regional Parks, and 20% for Greater Minnesota Parks. And that's what the governor has recommended in his budget to you.
Thank you.
Any further questions or arguments? Senator Scoy.
Well, is there consensus around that?
That's what it sounds like.
I don't know. That's what it sounds like?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, there was consensus among those 9 people on the work group, developing a recommendation that went to the governor. There may be differences of opinion outside of that work group, however.
Well, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Scoy, to your point, I don't know that there is, and I guess I'd like to know that as well. I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, we are having a report from the Metro Regional Parks. Are we going to have a report from the DNR next, I believe? No, I'm sorry.
Commerce is next today, but we will have a report from
you
the
will
DNR
have
eventually.
Okay, yeah. So that'll
yeah. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steffer, what is the 40-40? I mean, what are the variables or the factors that 40-40-20 formula is based on?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, the work group tried to look at a variety of data, looking at population, looking at visits, looking at the amount of money spent to operate and maintain parks and trails. And unfortunately, Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails did not have comparable data to what Metro Regional Park System has and the DNR Park System has. So they then looked at, well, how can we split the pie on an interim basis until we have that data? And the logic was that there's near home recreation. People are traveling a relatively short distance to use parks and trails of regional significance and state parks. And there's tourism aspect of this. 80% was allocated for near-home recreation and 20% for tourist-based recreation. Out of that 80%, because the state's population is not split 50-50 between Metro and Greater Minnesota, it's approximately 54% metro, 46% greater Minnesota, but there is a growth factor occurring in greater Minnesota that over by the year 2035, it'll be 52% of the population will be in the metro area, and 48% will be in greater Minnesota. So the logic was, well, let's split that 80% in half, 40% to the metro regional park system, and the other 40% to greater Minnesota. Now, as Senator Dibble pointed out, 71 of those state parks are in greater Minnesota, so the state park system is serving greater Minnesota as well as these regional parks. So out of that 40% that was going to greater Minnesota, half, or 20%, was attributed to DNR parks, and the other 20% to grants for parks in greater Minnesota. And then the tourist-based recreation, all that of that 20% was appropriated or allocated to the DNR state park system. So that's the logic behind the recommendation.
Senator Dibble, are you done? Senator Skoy?
Thank you. And maybe, Mr. Chair, when the Department of Natural Resources come and talks about the state parks, they would bring some information about, you know, where the visitors and the users of the state parks are from, because I don't think that they're just servicing people who live close to them. I think they're servicing a much broader base of people, because the nature of the park is it's many times overnight stays and stuff like that. But be interested in what kind
of
information.
If you ever run against Senator Dibble, you don't want to campaign on his park near his house, because there's nobody from his district.
Unless you're running statewide.
Yeah, well, neither one of those are going to have much chance of that, either one of those happening. So.
Okay, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So I can squelch that governor rumor that I've been hearing about.
You can squelch that right now.
Mr. Chair, just a comment with the potential demographics he's talking about, the testifier is talking about, with the seven-county metro, it's still, you know, if 20% for rural Minnesota is an awful lot, I still have to argue the fact that rural Minnesota now being fairly new in the system, in the park system, and I think you'll agree with that, probably not having all their ducks in a row, if you will, certainly in the future with the legacy funding, should see their share, their fair share, and that might even have to, in my view, increase a little bit more than the 20, but that's just me, so thanks.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I would strenuously disagree with idea. These are not state parks.
We understand.
They're local parks.
Isn't there $100 million in just maintenance that we have backlogged in our state parks?
Boy, I don't know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And the experts are saying yes. So there's an awful lot of needs out there for all our parks. So any other comments regarding the budget of the Metro State Parks? Metro Regional Park System. Sorry. Freudian slip. Yes, Senator Saxhog. Senator Saxhog.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll make the final word, and I'll tell I'll congratulate Mr. Stafford on a great park system.
Thank you.
And see, that was a compliment from rural Minnesota, so that's good. All right. Thank you, Mr. Stafford. Commerce Department, please. Do you need the computer? No? And you want to shut that thing down and get done. Mm-hmm. I'll let Mr. Stafford get out of your way first before we go any further. Commissioner, welcome back to the committee. Nice to see you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to be here.
Go ahead.
All right. Well, I think being handed out now is a one sheet, fact sheet, that I'll start with, and then we'll turn to the second handout, which has more of the budget information in it.
Commissioner, why don't you just say your name for the
yes, record. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Rothman, Commissioner of Commerce. So if you this plays off of, and I was here a couple weeks ago, Mr. Chair, we did an overview of the department, what we do, and I thought just as a refresher, a little bit of fun fast facts about the Department of Commerce, what the services we provide, and our overall mission. Then I will sort of tee up a little bit of the work that we did to put together our budget proposal, and then turn it over to Tim Janke, the Director of Administrative Services, my Chief Financial Officer, who's with me here today. So as you'll see, the Department of Commerce, and as you know, regulates and is responsible for banking, insurance, financial companies, the securities regulation at the state level, as well as energy, telecommunications, and 20-plus financial services or related industries that we work on. So you'll see we oversee $53 billion in bank, credit union, and finance company assets. We make sure that these institutions operate in a safe and sound manner. As well, we oversee $5.3 billion in the securities investment advisor assets under management, $258 billion of insurance company assets, 348,000 individuals and entities are licensed through the Department of Commerce. If you look at, on the energy side, some interesting facts, but important facts. In 2012 alone, we saved $130 million for ratepayers based on our recommendations in keeping energy rates low. We service 163,000 low-income folks in the LIHEAP program last year. We're roughly on pace for that again this year. We weatherize 9,000 households.
Commissioner, does that get to everybody who needs it, that 163,000, or are we still falling short on that?
It was short last year. Two factors, not just the number, not only the number of people served, but the amount served. We had to reduce our budget per household to pay those folks. So last year we were a little lower than average. This year we're trying to get that tweaked up a little bit.
So you got to the same number of people, but they got less money?
Right.
Senator Scoy, did you have a question there, or were you just fixing your glasses? Sorry. Okay.
Then on weatherization, we have the numbers of 9,000 homes last year. In terms of the electricity saved through the conservation improvement plans that we work and administer is 980,000 megawatts. On the natural gas side, it's 2.8 million metric cubic feet. And then if you look at the numbers in terms of how many cases we look at, we're dealing with over 10,000 investigations. That's all financial services. That could be securities, insurance, or anything in our financial services side. With the unclaimed property program, and you'll see dedicated some resources to that. We not only have more unclaimed property revenue coming in because we beefed up compliance, but we also have returned $19 million to 7,200 Minnesotans who have claimed unclaimed property. Roughly, that's it's over 30% of the money going back. You see the Petra Fund numbers, and then the number of people that our relay service helped, the deaf and hard of hearing, is well over 54,000 annually. Those are just highlights. There's a lot more that the agency does. And you can see on the services side, primarily advocating for the public interest. We do a lot of education, outreach. We do the licensing activity, compliance, and we oversee the financial institutions. primarily and important for me is to make sure that we have the safe and sound banking institutions in Minnesota, that our insurance companies are stable and competitive. With all of that, my goal is to make sure that we have strong financial institutions so our economy works well and that we have strong business activity. Jobs in the economy are significant and important for all of us. And then as well, we've been the lead agency on broadband expansion. We'll talk a little bit about that as we go along. And then I call it the diamond in the rough, with which you heard me before about the weights and measures unit and what we do on that side of regulation. So if you would, we'll go to the second handout. That kind of gives you the overview. The second handout is really the budget numbers. And as we lead into this, I'll tee it up and describe some of the sort of the macro changes in the department, the needs that we have, and the necessities, and why we're presenting the governor's budget recommendations as they are today. The first thing I want to mention is that last week I promoted to Deputy Commissioner Tim Vandehey to be the Deputy Commissioner of Insurance. He was an assistant commissioner, but because of the work that he's done and all the work that we're doing, made that promotion. And then we also have in place a search for the Deputy of Banking, and Mary Jo Wall will serve as the Acting Deputy Commissioner until we find a permanent replacement. So let me make three or four overall comments. Compared to the last biennium, to explain some of the numbers that the committee will see, and for those of you that have worked on our budget before, one is that I did a fairly significant reorganization of the department in some of the bigger areas. One was to combine most of the insurance regulatory functions under one umbrella. So that brought the financial oversight, policy analysts, workers' comp folks, and some others all within and under Tim Vandehey. So basically those came from what would have been what is our financial institutions area and what had been called the market assurance area. It was under that bucket. So the market assurance area, which is now called enforcement, looks a lot different, but it's between the two of them and all of these areas, we still have the same functions. The other area that changed a little bit is our administration area. Under Tim's management, we have three units plus the financial management and the human resources. Those three are the unclaimed property unit, licensing, and our consumer response team. And then in the enforcement area, where a lot of our core functioning of the enforcement investigation activities are, there are our civil investigations, securities, and the insurance fraud division. So overall, our budget remains the same generally, but we do have some change items. The governor had asked that all of us in the commissioner level look at our budgets, find areas where the needs and necessities are, and then also to see if there's any places for enhancements, if there are any, for revenue. And you'll see that in our budget presentation. Just a reminder to me that when I started, the department was operating on a very lean basis. It is currently, and that what we're proposing here are some strategic investments, both in deferred maintenance issues and as well on pressures and demands on our regulatory responsibilities. Those include, if you think about these areas, mortgage examinations, largely because of all the mortgage and financial crisis issues and our responsibilities for oversight there. Second of all, you'll see that in addition to last year, on top of the request that we asked for last time, we're asking for additional resources to keep pace with a lot of the areas. One is the energy rate filing area. The second is securities. Securities, when I inherited the department, had basically been left with practically nothing left for oversight. But we've needed to beef it up, especially in particular because of the financial sector, but also because the feds and the SEC have beefed up the state transferred actually state regulatory responsibilities from the feds to the state. And as I had indicated before, we now oversee $5.3 billion in assets under management, and we're required to have an examination program in place. Consumer affairs, and then as the other areas are insurance analysts. The pace of all of the activity that we do is increased, and in order to meet the burdens and demands on our staff, we find that these areas are needed for shoring up. And then finally, just another big area that has come to us is, Mr. Chair, as we talked about, is the broadband task force recommendations. What we had done in the department through the administration is put a placeholder in place. But what we have here is just one of the recommendations to staff some of the requirements or the suggested recommendations from the broadband task force. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Janke to walk you through the numbers and the budget as you go forward on these slides.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Janke, welcome to the committee. Just say your name for the record so we get your voice on here.
Mr. Chair, members, Tim Janke, Administrative Services Director and CFO at the Department of Commerce.
Thank you.
The slide you'll see here in front of you the next slide in the packet is the expenditures for the department over the coming biennium. It is about $454 million, just over $454 million for the biennium. You'll see that the largest portion of our budget is in the Division of Energy Resources, and that is just over $348 million. Primarily, we'll look in kind of in depth here at some of the programs and where the funding is, but primarily that's all federal dollars. Almost $300 million of that is for the LIHEAP program, flow-through federal dollars for those federal grant. $20 million of that is for the weatherization assistance program.
Are you on a certain page in here?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm sorry this is a smaller version, but it's the first pie chart that has the governor's recommendation. So you can see the other areas here. I won't walk through all of them. Just wanted to really highlight on this slide the large dollars that are spent out of the Division of Energy Resources. Moving to the next slide, looking at our total revenues for the coming biennium, it's just over $590 million. For the biennium, again, the largest portion of that is going to be in federal funds. $325 million of those dollars are federal funds. Special revenue funds, we're at $56.6 million for the biennium. Those special revenue funds include things like our auto theft prevention program, our insurance fraud division, conservation improvement program, and routing and siting. Those are just some examples of it, and we'll look at some more in detail here in a minute. And then the rest is non-dedicated revenues. Those non-dedicated revenues are made up of the licensing revenues for the licensees that the commissioner mentioned earlier, our unclaimed property program, mutual fund fees that are paid into the state, and then fines and penalties. Those are some of the examples of kind of those non-dedicated revenues that the department collects. Moving on to the next slide.
So the difference, or did you say that? I'm just looking real quickly, you bring in more than you spend of general fund money, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we do. The next slide actually highlights that in more detail.
Yes, all right.
I think we talked a little bit about this before, but the amount of net revenue generated is about $136 million. Most of the difference is the amount that is to the general fund.
Mr. Chair, you can see here on the bottom in the orange portion of the slide, general fund revenues are in excess for the coming biennium of $208 million, and the general fund appropriation that the governor has recommended is $46 million. The other funds portion of the budget here, we have expenditures of $408 million and then revenues of $382. So those would be made up of all other funds, including federal funds, special revenue funds, And the differences between those, generally those are all pass-throughs, but the difference here between the revenues and expenditures on those other funds is the fact that we'll have some carry forward from the prior biennium coming in, and we're going to be spending down some of those balance forward dollars.
And the carry forward is from any number of things, or?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, that would be from basically it's going to be generally in some of our special revenue accounts where we've had some balances that for whatever reason, operating dollars, you know, cash flow purposes or just things that hadn't been, for instance, in our SIP area, we've had some assessments and we've been we're waiting to get out some kind of larger we've had RFPs out there for some larger projects, and those dollars are sitting there, so now we'll be spending those in the coming biennium.
So you have more general fund revenue than you spend. So has the governor already tapped that in the rest of his budget? I would assume he has. But
generally, those dollars historically have it's been that way for I don't know how many years, certainly well before I started. And I think between the legislature and the governor, those dollars have been budgeted in one way or another.
You have a question? Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions. Maybe you want to wait. But with regards to the unclaimed properties, you got, according to the report here, the first page, you returned $19 million in 2012. Can you give the group a little idea here as to how much you actually figure on revenue over the average, how much per year average revenue on unclaimed? And how long do you hang on to that property before you actually liquidate it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebretson, I'll just give you some of the overall numbers. On average, over the last 10 years, the amount has been right around 58, 59, 60 million in revenue that comes in. Last year, fiscal year, 63 million. We're on target, actually, from July 1 of last year through today, to be on pace to about a $60 million amount for fiscal year 13. So it's, you know, $55, $60 million. There's one outlying year back in 06 where it was $112 million. That was due to the demutualization of some of the insurance companies and then those dollars flowing into the unclaimed property area. So on average, if you look at it, I think historically the amount that comes in and the amount that goes out paid back to citizens is about a third. So the difference over time, in general, the way that's been accounted for, and I'll defer to Mr. Jenke a little bit too on this, is that the revenue that comes in is deposited into the general fund. And the way that I say this is that if any Minnesota citizen or anybody has unclaimed property due to them, there's no statute of limitations. It's there. It's, if it's found or you're matched up with it, you can always make a claim for it, and the state will make good for the outstanding amount. And you know, I think it's just due to the historical numbers that you know we're easily able to keep pace with the demands on the unclaimed property claims that are being made.
Are these unclaimed properties anything, or are we talking life insurance? Are we talking home sales? Or what becomes unclaimed?
Mr. Chair, it's anything that is sheets. It's a sheetment to the state. So whenever somebody passes away and it's not passed on to a beneficiary, it under law, the sheetment law of Minnesota, it becomes a property of the estate. It's administered through the Department of Commerce through the Unclaimed Property Program. So it's things like, yes, life insurance policy payments. Another category would be securities. Things that are left in safe boxes at banks, payroll checks that people forget about, surprisingly, utility bills that have been paid, if you pay overpay your utility, whatever it is, they're required to pay those monies back to the state if they can't find the people. And then, any company that has salary payment benefits that are due to anybody. They're required to turn those over to the state, so it all comes in as unclaimed property.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a website where you can go online and determine if you or anybody you know has unclaimed property?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dietzick, absolutely. I love telling people this. 1 out of 10 Minnesotans has an unclaimed property claim just waiting for them, and it's over $100. We have a website. It's the Department of Commerce website. You just click on it. In fact, there's a database called missingmoney.com, I think it is. It's right on our website. You plug in your last name, and it searches. It'll tell you if you have anything over $100. We went out to the Mall of America last year and did a program with Good Morning America highlighting. I don't know if anybody saw this, but Good Morning America did a program with us. And one of the highlights was a family that that received well over $60,000 in insurance policy proceeds. They had no idea their parents had left when they passed away.
Wow. Well, How does it get paid then if they don't file a death certificate with the life insurance company?
So then they just make a claim to Mr. Chair. They make a claim to us at the department.
Who does?
The beneficiary, somebody whoever's entitled to the money.
Well, I understand that, but how do you get paid the life insurance proceed if the family didn't file a death claim to the life insurance company?
Because the proceeds were turned over to the state as general fund.
Who filed the claim with the life insurance company?
Well, the life insurance company was required to turn that over to the department. And so what we do is...
Hold it, because when I did life insurance policies, if somebody died, I actually had to file a death claim certificate with the life insurance company in order for them to pay. So who files the death claim certificate with the life insurance company if the family doesn't do it?
Well, in that case, you're right, Mr. Chair, there would be a true-up to try to get to the bottom. Sometimes those dollars are already turned over to...
So these life insurance companies don't give money away unless somebody asks for it. I know that, but...
Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right, and that's, we work through the process to get those dollars paid out.
I don't know how it works, but anyway, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that same vein, you said you can reimburse people who have overpaid their electrical bills. Tell me how that works. How do you get those dollars from the electric company?
Janky, I think this is your category.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the companies are required by law to make a certain number of attempts to contact those individuals. So, for instance, if somebody was in their home and they had made some payments and then they moved to California or something, and the company could no longer find them. They're required to make every effort to find them and track them down. If they're unable to do that after 3 years of no contact, that's when those dollars would then be turned over to the state. So, in essence, if you overpay your bill and you're still living at your residence, then that would just obviously be a credit on your next statement. But it would be in cases of where people move or are the companies are unable to find them anymore.
Okay, you guys must be doing a pretty good job because I can't believe you're getting money out of these companies like this. This is good.
Mr. Chair, it's one of the efforts. In fact, the legislature appropriated additional dollars to us in the last biennium to beef up the compliance portion of the unclaimed property program, realizing basically that the benefit out of the compliance exceeds the amount that you invest into it. And so we do have a beefed up compliance requirements for these companies to turn the dollars over to the state. It's all financial institutions, anybody who owes the state money.
You? No, you're just looking at me? You don't have a question? Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. No, actually, I can draw a scenario that might illustrate your example, and I'll run it past
Go ahead.
Mr. Rothman. Let's say that you have an life insurance policy. You have people out in California. You have three or four different people that are listed on the life insurance policy. Two of them live in California, one in Minnesota, one in Idaho. And the one in Minnesota you can't find. The people in California file a death certificate so that it satisfies the insurance company, so they start paying out. But there's 10% that goes to somebody in Minnesota, and they can't find it. There's where your money is. Is that a logical explanation of how you got the money?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's one of them.
But among others.
There's many others,
okay,
yeah.
That explains it. That was very good. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I work for an insurance company, so very familiar.
I did, too. That's why I was wondering why they were paying things out when they didn't have to.
Mr. Chair, you're exactly right. They don't pay unless they're told to.
Okay. But no, this 1 in 10 thing, everybody should check this website. What is it, Missing Money? Missingmoney.com. I'm glad you got it.
Ingebrigtsen with an I.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Don't bother Senator Ingebrigtsen tonight. He'll be busy on the computer. So.
I noticed that wallet doesn't open very often.
Right. Nothing there.
He doesn't want his confirmation money to get out.
So, Mr. Chair, if anybody has any issues and they need help with that, let me know.
Okay, Mr. Jenke, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, moving on to the next slide. Basically, the next couple of slides here basically just highlight what I tried to do here is just to highlight some of the areas within, kind of breaking it down to the next level for some of the divisions within our agency, to try to identify some of the larger programs there for the members. So within the Division of Energy Resources, you can see I'd mentioned earlier, the LIHEAP program, Low Income Heating Assistance Program, is just under $298 million a year. For the biennium. The Weatherization Assistance Program is just under $20 million. Conservation Improvement is about $9 million. Routing and Siting is $6 million. The State Energy Program, which is another federal program, is right around $3 million. And then basically kind of all of the other, there's lots of programs that are kind of under that $3 million biennial total, and a total of $348.3 million of spending for the biennium in energy resources. Our financial institutions division really has kind of one major program. They're listed there.
Would be RDF? Is that in there somewhere?
The RDF is within the Division of Energy Resources, and it would be in the all other. Senator, it's most of those RDF dollars are gone. They were appropriated a couple of biennia ago, and we have a few little bits of money that are still kind of remaining and getting spent, but there's no new money flowing in to the state for the RDF.
There will be, though, right?
Mr. Chair, I think there was some Mr. Mueller might know more, but I think there was some legislation last time that no more RDF dollars can be taken out of the RDF account and moved into the state agencies and into state accounts. It all has to remain within the RDF.
That doesn't mean we can't tap it if we want to, right?
Well, you Mr. Chair, that's within your purview and not mine.
It's the Senator Dibble.
Senator Dibble, very careful.
Well, it has to be for renewable energy, of course. Anyway, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the insurance division, you can see here kind of the biggest area of it is going to be insurance exams and regulation at about $14 million for the biennium. We did get some rate review grant funds from the federal government that total about $2.3 million and a total of $17.7 for the biennium. The enforcement division, investigation and review is at just under $8 million. Our license technology surcharge, 5.8. Auto theft is 4.2.
License technology surcharge?
Mr. Chair, that is it was probably about 4 years ago. We began doing online licensing. It was maybe even longer ago than that with products, the online products from Circon and Pulse. Those are the product names or the vendors that we use. And we work, folks in our licensing area work with the industries, and they pay to help support the cost of those programs. They pay a surcharge. It's up to $40. The current charge is $30 per license per year. And that will be going down to $25 per license, I believe, on May 1st. And so that money goes into this account, and what it's used for is to pay for the cost to run the system, upgrades, and those types of things for those systems.
And these are all types of licenses?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And so they have some kind of new little chip on them or something like that? Is that why it's called license technology surcharge, or just for the technology to put the license out?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, all right. The next one's my favorite one. That keeps getting bigger and bigger, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, members, the auto theft prevention program is at $4.2 million for the biennium, and the insurance fraud prevention is at $3.4 million, for a total of $22.5 million for the biennium.
You know, when you go through enforcement division, give me an idea of the type of enforcement people that we have. When I think of enforcement, I think of, you know, Senator Ingebrigtsen and sheriffs and stuff like that. But we must have CPAs, and who are some of the type of people that you have that for enforcement?
Mr. Chair, there's investigators on the civil side. So they could be an accountant, they could be specialized, you know, investigators trained to go in specifically, for example, to find and locate insurance fraud that's out there. They are also market conduct examiners. So market conduct examiners will look at business practices for a big swath of, so for example, the insurance area. And then we also have some licensed peace officers. So yes, folks who on the insurance fraud area are licensed to and do have a peace officer designation. So they investigate criminal conduct. And then there are some analysts that support a variety of these areas. So they actually look at the data, the analysis that goes behind some of the, you know, the stuff that we have. It's a variety, both civil, criminal investigators who have that background in, you know, investigating problems, complaints, market conduct practices.
And so they have the ability to subpoena and to walk into businesses and look at the books and stuff like that. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Exactly.
Okay. Mr. Jenke.
Mr. Chair, members, moving to the next slide, you can see the telecommunications division here. They totaled $12 million for the coming biennium. $2 million is a general fund appropriation that does the general regulatory affairs, and then as well there's the Telecommunications Access Minnesota at just over $9.6 million for the biennium. That program distributes equipment to those deaf, blind, and hard of hearing folks in the state, as well as relay service. And then the Office of Broadband Development is, the commissioner talked about that a bit earlier. There's a $500,000 amount here to staff a couple of positions within the department, and we'll talk about that kind of a little bit more here when we get into the change items.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair, regarding the Office of Broadband Development, obviously I'm supportive of it, and I'm glad that the governor's put it in his budget, but do you think, Commissioner, should we be concerned that you have the regulation authority and now we're going to move into the development? Is there any conflict in that? I mean, in rural Minnesota, certainly broadband development, you could argue, would be an economic development tool, and I'm not trying to steal any of your money or thunder, but just your thoughts on that, maybe?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sparks, I don't think that there's a conflict necessarily. The Department of Commerce has the telecommunications oversight under it generally. It has some of the expertise with the staff, the analysts, the people that understand telecommunications, and the history of, so for example, the history of the ERA funding deployment of stimulus dollars that went into the state. That was through the Department of Commerce staff to monitor and oversee that. The regulatory aspects of the department in terms of our regulatory responsibilities is really focused on the telephone companies historically. So of the pie of telecommunications, it's a telephone companies that we do that the the oversight in terms of what we do there with the Public Utilities Commission. So wireless, cable, all the stuff that's sort of federally regulated is regulated by the feds. And then the question becomes, you know, where's the best, where are the best minds to be able to do the question of developing out the broadband stuff? There's no disagreement that the development includes economic development. So the governor issued an executive order when he did the broadband development task force, beefed up the broadband development office in the Department of Commerce, but then designated three agencies to be lead in terms of broadband. One is Department of Commerce. Second is economic development, so with Commissioner Clark and myself. And the third is what's now called MINIT, but OET, so Commissioner Parnell. And the three of us meet from time to time to put our minds together in terms of all of this stuff that we're doing. So it's a combined effort, and we recognize that. And then our staff at the Department of Commerce staffed Margaret Anderson Kelleher's governor's broadband development, broadband task force. So we have the staffing to support it in terms of where things are going for the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was very helpful.
So, Commissioner, so in the budget book it says broadband task force $500,000. You know, on your handout here it says Office of Broadband Development. Is that the same thing or are they different?
It's the same thing. To be precise, it would be $500,000 to the Department of Commerce in the area of the Office of Broadband Development. It comes out of it's one of the recommendations in the governor's task force to do.
So to follow up on Senator Sparks' question, is the money for the task force to make recommendations for our broadband policy, or is it actually for developing broadband, coming up with broadband initiatives?
It's the latter, Mr. Chair. The recommendation from the task force was to put staff in place at the department so that there's sort of an ongoing place where development analysis is happening at the staff level in the Department of Commerce.
And so then this would be ongoing money, not just one time.
That's correct, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Jenke.
Mr. Chair, members, the last category here is kind of an all other commerce programs. You can see in here that the petroleum tank cleanup fund is just under $21 million for the biennium. Weights and measures is just over $7 million. And then the consumer response, licensing, unclaimed property, and administrative services is just over $16 million for the biennium. That totals $44 million for those other programs. And then on the right side of the slide here, we just have totals for those areas, kind of carried those forward so you can see them all in one spot. Moving on to the next page is the first of the governor's recommendations for commerce. The first is titled Agency Investment with Revenue Offset. The general idea here is that the appointment fees that insurance companies pay to appoint agents for the company would be increased from $10 per appointment up to $30 per appointment. That would raise approximately $4.5 million annually. That would be non-dedicated general fund revenues. That appointment fee right now is $10, and it's kind of on the lower end of what the national average is. We'd move that up to $30. Beyond that, we would make investments in the agency, things that the commissioner had talked about earlier. We would add one FTE for mortgage investigations. We would add an FTE to do expedited rate review within the department or the Division of Energy Resources. Securities would add three staff, three examiners, including an audit director. for four total. Consumer Protection would have three FTE. We would add an internal auditor. We add a couple of staff in our enforcement area to do investigative work, and three insurance analysts.
That's on the first line there, the $2.5 million for the biennium.
Yeah, so, Mr. Chair, the first line shows the expenditures increasing $1.275 million per year. Those costs would cover the staff that I just mentioned. The increase in the licensing or in the appointment fee would generate $4.5 million per year. And the other $450,000, the difference between the $4.95 million and the $4.5 million that I just mentioned, that $450,000, would be generated from other assessment authorities that we currently have under law.
Is that anywhere in the budget book here? Or is that not a change item, so you didn't put it in here? The $450,000?
The 450?
Yeah.
It's in there, Mr. Chair.
I see it's in the $4.9 million, but it's not,
Mr.
It's
Chair,
not a
you're
line
looking
item, so I'm just wondering if it's something from that was not considered to be a change and was just included.
Mr. Chair, if you're looking specifically at the governor's the information that was printed on the MMB website, it doesn't call out the differences. It shows the total of $4.95 million of revenue per year.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't delineate the differences between the appointment fee and the fee for the assessments and other authorities that are currently under law.
Yeah, I noticed that. I was just wondering if you had it somewhere else, but apparently it's not in this book, right?
It's, Mr. Chair, we can provide some documentation with that for you.
Okay. Okay, keep going.
Moving to the next slide this is an extension of our unclaimed property of the program Commissioner was talking about earlier. 2 years ago, the legislature appropriated $375,000 per year for some additional staff in our unclaimed property compliance program. We would like to those funds run through fiscal year 15. So this proposal is to make those permanent. So put them into the out years. So you'll see that there's $375,000 per year, $750,000 for the biennium, for approximately four FTEs. And that will be offset by $1.875 million per year of additional revenue. So similar to what we were talking about earlier, as you have additional staff out there in the field doing compliance work, you'll generate additional revenues that will be deposited into the general fund. So this proposal would net $1.5 million per year, or $3 million for the biennium, to the general fund.
Questions?
Moving on, the next proposal is to invest in weights and measures division for some additional equipment. Actually to maintain existing equipment and invest in a little bit of new equipment. The general concept in this proposal would be there's a couple of different funding sources in current law for different ways that money is generated for the weights and measures division in the general fund. So there's two sources. The first one is that 81 cents of currently at 81 cents of every dollar. There's a dollar for every 1,000 gallons of fuel at the kind of wholesale level. 81 cents of that goes to the general fund, to the weights and measures program to fund the operations. So that's one portion of the funding. As well, the work that they do in the field generates fee revenues, and those are all non-dedicated general fund revenues. So the concept here is we would increase that petroleum inspection fee from 81 cents to 89 cents and increase the fees that are paid on their on the fees, the fee activity work by 30%. So this is a complicated one, Mr. Chair, and I think it might be best at some point for Mr. Mueller and I to kind of sit down and walk through so he's comfortable with it. But
you might want to walk through it with the chair, too.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, what it does is, in essence, it increases our expenditures in the special revenue fund by $276,000 per year, and it increases our revenues in the special revenue fund by $276,000 per year. So, basically, we're increasing our revenue and expenses there. And it increases our general fund revenues by $54,000 over what they currently are. So it nets $54,000 per year to the general fund.
And that's including that 30% fee increase you mentioned?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Because I don't see that in your budget book anywhere. I see something about fee increases, but I don't see 30% or anything. So.
Mr. Chair, it's not spelled out specifically in the budget book.
How much are these fees right now that are collected from businesses and other governmental entities for inspectors? How much is it different for every business or different for every governmental unit, or and how is it? You got an idea how it's determined?
Mr. Chair, members, there is a whole kind of list of fees that we have, and if we get too far into the weeds here, I'm going to have to defer to our Weights and Measures Director, Julie Quinn, and she can talk about them in more depth for you. But there's a whole lot of fees that are charged. We have kind of a large fee schedule. So if you want, we can bring Julie up, and she can talk about them a little bit more.
Mr. Chair, just a few of them. You know, there's package inspection fees, scale fees, petrol lab fees, metrology and zone fees. These are the fees for the services that are provided by the Weights and Measures Unit.
And so are these fees increasing 30% across the board, or are they depending upon the fee?
Across the board.
And then why?
These fees, well, a couple of reasons, actually. When you look at the needs of that area, the weights and measures area, there's been a lot of deferred maintenance for many, many years in terms of what's needed. So for example, someone on the expenditure side, the needs that the unit needs, there are some some old trucks that have some safety issues that relate to them. There's light unit vehicles that are out there that need to be upgraded. And then when you look at what's needed to maintain the unit, these fees have not been touched in quite a long, long time. They are key to the gross domestic product since the last fee increase. So what we did is we try to look at them and say, okay, here's our need. The lab itself is increased services. Like I mentioned, it is one of the crown jewels in the upper Midwest. So we service North Dakota, some of the surrounding states. They actually bring their trucks here. They bring their facilities here, so we do all the calibration. So it seemed a little bit, number one, inequitable. Number two, we need to upgrade our equipment and resources. Inequitable in the sense that we should invest in the unit so that we have and can continue to maintain what we have and make sure that these fees are appropriate to the services that we provide everybody. So in looking at all of that, it felt best to address these necessities in the unit by also addressing the fees that people are being charged in terms of the services that we're providing to them.
So are the fees in statute? Are they in rule? Or are they just a Commerce Department policy? How are they administered?
Mr. Chair, the fee schedules are all listed on our website currently. Those are the fees that are being charged. They're all out on the Weights and Measures portion of the website right now.
So they're not delineated in rule or in statute anywhere then, right? You just have the authority to do that, or
Mr. Chair, there's a very old set of rules that were from quite some time ago that have fee structures set in them, and we've gone through the process since then to update those fees and are currently using what's on the website.
So Mr. Chair, on that, just to add that the rule, it used to be done by rule, but then apparently by statute, it allows the department to do it every 6 months to make sure the fees are appropriate to the services provided, but it has not been done since 2003.
And these out-of-state people that come in to use our services, do we charge them out-of-state fees or? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, just to get some clarification here, we're talking about weights and measures. So we're talking about gas pumps, we're talking about scales, et cetera, right?
Yes.
And so now if my grain elevator or what have you, you talk about a 30% increase in fees, if my grain elevator or my convenience store operator or what have you, when you talk about 30%, what are we talking about in dollars and cents as far as increases that our businesses are going to face?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, I'm going to ask Julie Quinn, the director of the Weights and Measures Division, to kind of go through some of those.
Why don't you close that computer?
Yeah.
Get that out of your way. And say your name for the record, too, please.
I'm Julie Quinn as the director of the Weights and Measures Division, and thank you, Chair and Senators, for letting me speak.
I could see you were chomping at the bit back.
Our fees range from something as simple as $25 for a typical grocery scale up to, say, $150, $230, say, for a vehicle scale, depending on how many segments are in each of these. My understanding, I was still an investigator in the field in 2003, the last time these fees were assessed, but at that time, the fees, the formula used to calculate those fees were based simply on the time that the inspector spent at the location and in the cases of the heavy duty, the fuel that it took to get them to the inspection site without any calculation given to the wear and tear on the vehicles, the support staff back at the office, the replacement of the vehicles and the laboratory equipment. Besides the obvious things that you think of weights and measures, testing your scales and your gas pumps, we have a metrology lab that tests not only service agents' field standards and our own field standards, but say you're a manufacturer in Minnesota and you have a quality control program. You have to meet some ISO standard or something like that. You bring your weights that you use in your manufacturing process to us to be certified against against the state standards, which trace back to the national standards, so that you can meet your quality control program. If you're exporting grain to Canada or something like that, that's going across a GPSA scale that we do. Our fees, it does sound enormous to do a 30% increase, but when you look at the fact that the increase in fuel costs and the increase in just in general cost all the way around, and now I've got a fleet of 21 vehicles plus laboratory equipment that were always previously replaced on a catch as catch can. I got a little extra. Maybe I got $5,000. Oh, maybe I can upgrade a piece of lab equipment. You know, can I get one truck out this year? What this asking for this increase is to create a budget so that I can replace my vehicles on a regular schedule, so that as our laboratory equipment reaches obsolescence, that we can plan to replace that equipment. Because we're also testing your quality of your fuel, for example, that the octane is what it's posted at the pump, that it doesn't contain contaminants, that it's not got water or you've got diesel mixed with gasoline or gasoline mixed with diesel or some of that. And all of that requires pretty sophisticated equipment but we know how much it costs. We can pretty much budget that $250,000 to $270,000, at least for the foreseeable future, should get me a program that I can increase those. You know, I can replace those pieces of equipment in a logical way. That was more than you probably asked for.
What if we didn't get the fee increase? We'd still have to do the work, right? And then what?
Well, then we continue in the catch-can. What is the greatest safety hazard out there? Which vehicle is going to pose the biggest problem? Maybe I lose an ability to test, to do a test in the laboratory. For instance, balance a heavy-duty truck, one of these big trucks that do the vehicle scales, that got a hoist, and they've got 2,000 and 1,000-pound weights that they put out on a 2,000-pound weight cart and drive around the scale. That poses a danger of life and limb both to the employee but to the general public if that is not roadworthy and safe. So obviously I'm going to take replacing that as a higher priority than, say, one of my distillation units in the petroleum lab that's looking at your fuel quality. I might just not be able to provide that service to you. Those are the kind of choices we'd have to make.
You have a real lot of fees. Holy man. These little computers are great. Senator Dibble. Or Senator Ingebrigtsen, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And okay. Ms. Quinn, so I'm a little confused in that you've been charging prorated fees going up according to the amount of distance and what it costs to serve. Is that correct? If that were the case, wouldn't you be figuring in your replacement costs and stuff? No?
There's a zone charge that is incurred if you call me out to do, if you call one of my inspectors out to do a special inspection for you. If he's in your for instance, I have have one inspector, heavy-duty inspector, up in the northwest corner. He's got a quarter of the state is his, the landmass of the state is his territory. And he works it town by town, county by county, to be the most efficient. If you have a new scale or you have a repair on your scale and you don't want to pay a private service company to place it back in service, you want me to my inspector to come out and make a special inspection on your scale to get it back into commercial use. If he can fit it into schedule and do this, he's going to charge you that zone charge for driving all the way across there and disrupting that schedule. Then that's what it's covering. If you're on your routine, if it's on the routine annual inspection, if I'm working in Perham, then I'm not going to charge you a zone charge for working in Perham.
Just to follow up, real quickly follow up. So out-of-state services were mentioned. You do some calibration of out-of-state services. Do you charge them?
Any service that we would charge for, we charge everybody the same. Now, there are two kinds of out-of-state services we generally do. One would be service agencies from other states that are working in Minnesota that may also work in, so they may be based in Iowa or South Dakota or Wisconsin or North Dakota, whatever, and they're working in our state as well. They will often bring their standards to us. Because there are no, you know, we're the lab to go to in the upper Midwest. We also do state standards for surrounding states that do not have metrology labs. We charge them the same fees as everybody else, although that has been a subject of whether we could add. We've been looking into it, but one of the things is that there's some kind of legal issues about whether we can charge different fees for different climates that way. Might be that we set a certain fee, maybe a higher fee than what we're asking now, and then give a discount to Minnesota businesses if you wanted to look at it that way. But that's actually something that the commissioner's got to look into.
So I'm just looking at this chart on this little laptop here, and so it says a C8 commercial industrial scale over 30,000 pounds, the fee is $275. Is that the trucker would pay that every single time they go on the scale, or the scale operator? Who pays the fee?
Every, Mr. Chair, every scale owner has a responsibility to keep their scale in calibration, okay? We verify that they do that by coming and doing the test once a year or as staffing and allows. So we try to get there every 12 months, but might be 15 months, might be 18 months, depends on the area and the staffing. So so that owner pays that fee when we come out. So basically okay, once a year.
So it's once a year. Okay. All right. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Two quick things. One is when Mr. Jenke ran through the use of the – so going back to the first slide, the use of the funds for the $30 increase to – or the $20 increase. Anyways, in the first slide, you know, the $49.50. I didn't write fast enough. His actual verbal presentation was more detailed about the use of those dollars than what we find in the budget book. So you get more, if you could maybe write up, you know, what you explained to us. It's an ongoing frustration with these books, Mr. Chair.
The detail is... That's why we're having this 30% discussion right
severely
now.
Severely lacking. And then just a general question, and it doesn't necessarily need to be answered now, but, you know, we've got performance measures that accompany all of the change items in the governor's budget. I've got them in my budget books as well. Do we actually measure the performance measures in some form or fashion so that we know that we're getting from these investments what we state we'd like those outcomes to be? I don't know if you want to answer that now or not, and if we do, how do we do that?
Who wants to take that? Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble. we'll provide the background on the detail. Happy mm-hmm. to do that. The second, on the performance measurements, it was the governor's and the MMB's overall initiative to set up generic categories of performance measurements. And those performance measurements are ones in which we were asked to, you know, take a look at ourselves and see what is it that we contribute as value for services to the state of Minnesota to make it better. These performance measurements are specified not only just in the change items to the extent that we explain what it was and, you know, if you spend these dollars, the performance increases and all the stuff that we needed to do, but also generally. And to the extent that, you know, the department, for example, regulates banks, we look at what the staff does in terms of providing the service for oversight and regulation in terms of making sure we have safe and sound banks. So to the extent those measurements are good indicators that, you know, there's positive development, then in each of these areas we would do that. Same with insurance. And so, yes, there are some of them that we would look to determine, you know, is the work that the department doing contributing. Now, there's a bunch of categories. One is obviously the economy. another is in safety, health, because we do a lot of work in the insurance and health arena in collaboration with others. And you would count community and health. We do a lot of work on the energy side to, you know, save resources, save the environment, and those kinds of things. So there are specific data points that we have for each of these measurements and try to track them as we go.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, great. I'd love to see those at some point. That would be interesting. I know the City of Minneapolis does something very similar, and they publicly disseminate those, and they publicly discuss what the measures of success. And, you know, they're honest. Some stuff goes up, some stuff goes down. It's pretty good. I had a different question as well.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Chair. Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, there are some of the basic ones in as part of the department's. This document, the governor's budget and commerce. So we did put them in this document. Some of those are available. And
great.
And then as well, the performance measurements of our agency goes even a little bit deeper than that. But we're happy to provide those.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I guess I didn't realize weights and measures I guess it makes sense. They're not just measuring weight. They're measuring other things. It measures the appropriate blends and that sort of thing. I'm recalling a story, was it a year or 2 years ago, in which a big batch of gasoline had way too much ethanol in it. Was that something that the Weights and Measures Department discovered? And how did that get unearthed, and what was the upshot of that story?
Ms. Quinn, you're back up.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, yes. As part of the regulatory function of the Weights and Measures Division, it is actually making sure that, you know, the amount of octane is what it says it is, and make sure that that the blending that's happening and the ethanol and in the stream of the fuel supply is out there, and the Weights and Measures folks do go out and examine that. And then to the extent that there is a complaint or something like that that comes up, we will, Ms. Quinn and her staff will go out and investigate that. So on that one, there was an issue. So
the main thing was making sure we got all that bad product back.
Yeah. Go ahead. Why don't you do it?
Ms. Quinn.
Mr. Chair and Senators, the main issue I think the incident that you're recalling is a terminal that had a blending area problem through one of their manifolds, and a large amount of ethanol was released into gasoline in southern Minnesota. So the terminal did the responsible thing and notified us right away, and what our primary responsibility was to track that distribution through the system and make sure that we reclaimed every gallon of that inappropriate gas and that everyone had received it, had been notified, and it had been pulled back, and that the terminal had solved the problem before the fuel was again, you know, released out into the community. So that we worked to make sure the tanks were cleaned up. I mean, it obviously involved then, because people add the bad product onto good product, and so now you've got more than was originally sold. So we were doing tank tests around the clock. Our laboratory staff worked, you know, almost, like I said, around the clock with about five of our field staff who just did nothing but bring samples back in for them to test and get immediate results out to these tank owners to know whether they had, in fact, cleaned up the problem and had ASTM spec fuel that they could put back on sale.
Okay. Senator Westrom.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, two questions. Back to the vehicles and replacing them with the fee increase. What kind of schedule are you on right now of replacing vehicles? Every 5 years, every 10 years, 20 years? How old are the vehicles? what kind of replacement time are you on?
Ms. Quinn.
We're on pretty much every 10 years or longer on the vehicles currently, and we would like, which puts us at a place of risk, because if next year I don't run up enough excess to replace a vehicle, then I'm starting to run them longer, you know. I would say 10 to 15 years is the average life of one of our vehicles. On the heavy-duty vehicles, depends on which territory and how many miles, because we put so many miles. We try to replace boxes on them. They'll rust out or something like that. You can get a million miles on a diesel engine, so it depends on how many miles, how big your territory is, and how long you can make that last. But in generally, 10 to 15 years is where we're looking at.
Okay. The fees, you talked about we charge everybody the same, and we do out-of-state services. I guess it seems to me the first place we would look is charging the states that don't, that are benefiting from us having the infrastructure, the buildings, the program that we're offering them. I mean, to sell them the same service as the resident or business owner in Perham or Grand Rapids seems to me to almost be treating the ones out of state better and giving them a discount, because they're saving the cost of having all that infrastructure and we're funding it, and to charge them the same seems to me to be a discount on their services. Can you explain that or tell me where I'm thinking wrong?
Senator Westrom, I would not disagree with you. I would just say that I inherited that fee structure with no differentiation. I think I'm safe in speaking on the commissioner's behalf and saying he certainly would consider that if legal tells us that that's a possibility. But the volume of our out-of-state work is not significant. It's not like we're doing 50% out-of-state work and 50% in-state work.
What percentage would you say is out-of-state? 5%?
I would need to look at those numbers because I couldn't pull them out for service agencies. And service agencies, again, are kind of a dicey thing because they may exist out-of-state, but they usually work in our state as well, you know. So they're servicing our companies, and there's some benefit. In terms of surrounding states, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Iowa are using our services. But even if we charge them 10 times what we charge everybody else, that's not going to fund my equipment replacements. So.
Okay. Ooh, Mr. Jenke, you got more to go here, right?
Mr. Chair and members, I think we do have a couple more here. If we move on to the next page. The Governor's Rec has a joint study with the Department of Natural Resources. This would increase special revenue fund expenditures by $150,000 first year and $100,000, so a total of $250,000 for the biennium, as well as revenues. And what this is it would be a joint study with the Department of Natural Resources. The funding that's shown here is actually federal funds that would be drawn down by the Department of Natural Resources, and they would move those monies through us. Our department would use some existing resources as a state match on these federal funds. So we would have this study that would last over the 4 years that are shown here, 14, 15, 16, and 17, and totals $400,000 over that period of time. So what we're looking for here is the authority to accept those dollars that are flowing through the DNR and spend them.
And remind me, what? Tell me what the joint study is for again.
Mr. Chair, this is a study that the PUC has requested over a particular project on southeastern Minnesota.
Can we know the project, or?
Mr. Chair, it's a Goodhue project.
And what are they doing that they need to study it?
Well, in generally, the PUC and this project had a lot of issues and concerns raised about birds and bats, et cetera.
Okay, that thing. All right, okay.
Birds and bats and other major, actually, birds.
They use some big words, though.
Well, I tend not to. You know, I was advised once to think of my kids who are 13, 10, and 7, and just keep it simple.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
But it's like, I think
it's like
the one
like a compliment I got on my new glasses. Somebody said to me one time, "You look smarter with your glasses on." I didn't know if that was a compliment.
The word is ornithological, I think. But for me, it comes down to eagles and other major birds and bats that are at issue, and where do the developments go and what's best. So.
And what are we going to study?
Well, again, the PUC has asked that for this project that this study be done, working with the DNR and all to develop.
Because we know the windmills hit birds when they come through. So
that's pretty much it.
Or the other way around, yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, so.
The birds hit.
Did you want to tell me?
Yeah, that was it.
Okay. What do we expect to find that we don't know?
I think, Mr. Chair, that the goal was to make sure that the data, the analytics was there to know the numbers precisely before they proceeded.
You mean about whether or not we're going to hit the bats and the birds?
The impacts, yes.
Mm-hmm. Can't we get this from some place that's already hitting the bats and the birds?
Mr. Chair, I believe that there was some preliminary numbers and put into the record, and I think at the end of the day, the PUC decided to require a thorough analysis done.
Because, you know, we could use the money to teach people how not to lose their cars, too, if we, you know, that, instead of something we already know about, you know.
Mr. Chair, I'm all for that debate. I mean, I understand.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe somebody at the table knows about this thing that's been going around with regards to the eagles, the bald eagles getting a permit, some company getting a permit to allow X amount of bald eagles to be killed. Is there anything to that at all, or am I just anything to that study?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator Ingebrigtsen, as part of the Goodhue study, in fact, part of it includes the bald eagles. The area along the Mississippi and the Eastern Corridor is a flight path. It's also a nesting area. The department made some comments, others, with respect to this particular docket, the Goodhue County one, and it was not only our concern but others that there would be, you know, issues with respect to the eagles. Ultimately, though, the issue of permitting for eagles is a federal question, and so the developers and all for that project went to the federal government, and it's that determination which you may have in mind, which was in the paper a few weeks ago.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Just to follow up on that, talking with a CEO most recently about bald eagles, didn't realize that in Minnesota we have a lot of car kill bald eagles. I don't know if anybody knows that or not, but it's certainly a point of interest when we're considering how many there are and how many are getting killed by windmills. I think there's a whole bunch of them that are being killed by vehicles. Now, that was something new to me. I didn't know that, but apparently quite a few. So,
Mr. Chair and Senator, I mean, from my perspective, you know, it's a national symbol. We should be protecting it to the extent possible, and that's where my perspective is. And then as far as, you know, all of these issues, whatever we can do to protect them is important.
I don't think they're afraid of cars. I think that's the problem.
Yeah.
I was driving out on Highway 2, and there was a deer in the middle of the road, and the eagle was sitting right on that deer.
That's what it is.
And as I drove by, the eagle didn't fly away. Now, those crows, they fly away, but the eagles don't fly away. Senator
Sackhoff. Mr. Chair, the eagles are a lot bigger. Their wingspan's about 5 feet. Huge. The crows are about 2. That's the difference.
But they fly away. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
I think it was determined that every vehicle that's killed one has been fueled by ethanol, too. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, in Minnesota, that would be true because 10% of all our fuel is ethanol.
Ooh, so see, it was true.
Mr. Chair, we just have one or two more.
Okay,
I think
good.
One slide left on the broadband.
Mr. Chair, members, the last governor's change item request is to fund 2 FTE for the broadband task force. This is $250,000 on an annual basis or $500,000 for the biennium from the general fund. That would staff 2 FTE. They would work on developing the Minnesota fiber collaboration database and a state dig once policy. Those are the primary focus. As well as working, as the commissioner talked earlier, on some of the other task force recommendations.
And that's the same $250,000 we talked about before, right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And is that it?
Yes.
Okay. How are you doing in getting the bill language drafted and put into bill form? Are we going to be on time?
Mr. Chair, we submitted draft language to MMB on Friday. They're the ones who kind of consolidate it for the all. I mean, obviously, we're just one piece of the bill for your area. So we have that draft language up with them. We still owe them a little bit of information, but my understanding is I think we're tracking on time.
Okay, so my expectation is that we'll probably get one great big bill for my committee, or maybe we won't. I don't know. Maybe we'll get an ag bill. Maybe we'll get a commerce bill. Maybe we'll get a I don't know, maybe we'll get an environment bill. I don't exactly know what's going to come here. There could be a whole bunch of bills that will end up in an omnibus bill. But I think at any rate, what we will probably do is take them section by section. So you guys will probably be back here again. And I don't know how long that will take us, but it all depends on how many things change and how many things stay the same, I guess. So you were about to say something, Senator?
I do actually have a question, and Game and Fish, I understand, is going to be chaired by the good senator from Red Wing. Is that correct? Is that not incorrect? Or?
What do you mean, Game and
that's
Fish?
In the policy committee.
Wait, do you want him to? We can let him do it up here just for a little experience.
Sure,
We'll get you on TV and stuff if you want, Matt. And,
Mr. Chair, if you'd like to give me a budget to work with, too, I'd be happy to take that. So
I'm trying to find out.
I think this is a great idea.
All right. Anything else anybody has? Okay. All right. In that case, thank you very much, everybody, and meeting's adjourned. All right.